Okay, in the brief time that we have, I'd like to try to look at a lot together. We have Tazria and Metzora this week, and it's also Yom HaAtzmaut. And to try to see perhaps some of the themes from all three of those in just a few minutes, and we'll also try to stick to our policy of looking at Shani, but maybe we'll have to play with the format a little bit and talk more about the parashios in general, maybe go outside the boundaries of some of these aliyos. But one theme that we know connects Tazria and Metzora, even though it's not explicit in either of the parashios, is the theme of Lashon Hara. And that's actually more halachically located in Parshas Kedoshim, which we have coming up very soon. Tazria Metzora does not actually mention Lashon Hara, but we have a strong tradition from Chazal that that's what's behind the scenes. That the affliction that is described in these parashios, Gemara and Erechin tells us, Chazal tells us in a number of places, that it's a physical affliction with spiritual causes. That Lashon Hara is prominent on the list. It's not the only thing on the list. The Gemara and Erechin lists a few other averus also that could bring about negayim, bring about the afflictions that we read about here. But Lashon Hara is the one that is most well known, and the notion of the word Metzora is a contraction of Motzi Shemra, as Chazal tell us. And Motzi Shemra, in modern usage, we draw a distinction between the words Lashon Hara on the one hand and Motzi Shemra on the other hand, based on the language of the Rambam and the Chafetz Chaim. These are two different types. That Lashon Hara is to say true, disparaging things about people, and Motzi Shemra is that which is false and slanderous. The truth is, in Chazal, it's not so clear that the phrases are used that differently. They both seem to be umbrella phrases that overlap. But the idea that Lashon Hara is something that is true, even if it doesn't exclusively mean that, it has always been a difficult concept to understand. That it's one thing to say you shouldn't slander someone. Okay, we understand that is a clear evil being done to someone else. To attach false accusations to another person, we could understand why that's a terrible thing to do. But if Lashon Hara at least includes saying true things, so what is so terrible about that? And there is a lot to understand about the nature of that particular Isser, and it's really a much larger topic. And it happens to also tie in with Arve Pesachim, and God willing, we'll have the opportunity to return to that point. But part of the idea of there being a prohibition of saying things which seem to be factually true is that it's very often not actually the emes, that even if what you're saying is not an overt lie, very often you can paint a very false picture by just zeroing in on one detail or taking one detail out of context or just simply slanting things in how you present things. You can say something which seems to be factually true, but you create a completely false picture. And that's important to appreciate because we have a prohibition of Lashon Hara in terms of how we speak about people. But there is a close parallel. There's a prohibition also of Dibas Haaretz, of how we speak about the land of Israel. And there you find the very similar overlapping ideas and the Chet HaMeraglim, which we still pay a price for Ad HaYom Hazeh. Tisha B'Av was the time of the Chet HaMeraglim, which Mara tells us God said was established as a Yom Bechil Adoros, is crying for all the generations. The Meraglim violated the notion of Dibas Haaretz, this parallel concept to Lashon Hara, and they have very strong connecting themes. That the same way one could say, what's so terrible about Lashon Hara if I'm making a legitimate complaint about someone, if I'm saying something that is true? Why shouldn't I be able to say it? And by the same token, one can say, if I'm making a legitimate complaint about the land of Israel, so what's wrong with that? I'm being honest. I'm telling you what I think. What's so terrible about that? So there's a lot that we can understand is very problematic, in addition to what we just said about possible distortions and omissions and out-of-context understandings and subjective perspectives. But there's also, by its very nature, a lack of appreciation, that if we really understood what a human being is about, if we really understood what our chaverim constitute as people, so then a lot of what we complain about really wouldn't matter, wouldn't rise on our radar screen. It wouldn't be something that we would notice. And the ability to focus on little details that make us unhappy very often is false because of what it doesn't say. It's false because you miss the perspective that is right in front of you, that you have an unbelievable human being who has all kinds of complexities and nuances and strengths and weaknesses, and all you see is this little detail that's getting in the way. And so too, Dibas Haaretz could reflect the same kind of attitude, that it's not that there isn't anything that one could complain about, but if one truly had an appreciation for the tremendous gift that the Kadosh Baruch Hu is bestowing with a land in which his presence can be felt most actually in the real world and can be given breath and can be actualized, and a atmosphere of holiness can infuse everything. So if one truly appreciated what that meant, so then what the Meraglim are complaining about and the complaints that we have in our generation wouldn't be on our radar screen. It wouldn't be something that would be worth mentioning. So the idea that there is a prohibition of Lashon Hara, which can undermine everything about how we relate to each other and needs to be fixed, and the idea of a prohibition of Dibas Haaretz, which essentially is saying no one's being told to lie, no one's being told to ignore the truth, but to keep your perspective and to appreciate that the tremendous gift that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was promising us at the time of the Meraglim, and that in our own generation we have seen flourish to a degree that 100 years ago no one could have imagined, and that we've seen such tremendous hashgacha and blessing and flourishing, that requires a proper orienting of perspective. And that's one of the major themes, really, that Dibas Haaretz and Lashon Hara share, and that our parshios are reminding us about. You know, the notion that tzaras is caused by Lashon Hara is not explicit, as he said, in these parshios. It is an idea that Chazal emphasized, but it is also somewhat explicit in the Torah, just not in these parshios. It is explicit in Parshas Balosra, because there Miriam contracts tzaras, and there it's quite evident that that is a consequence of the way she speaks about Moshe Rabbeinu. And there also, it's not 100% clear exactly how she was disparaging him in any significant way. And it's often explained, Soloveitchik commented upon this at length and others, that Miriam's real mistake was a lack of appreciation for the unique attributes of Moshe Rabbeinu. And so too, we have a notion of Dibas Haaretz and the Lashon Hara of individuals stems from failing to appreciate what is unique and special. And therefore, the ability to take a day of this year and to indeed acknowledge the amazing bracha that we have in our access and settlement, and that the whole world has to benefit from the presence of the State of Israel in this generation, is a focusing on what is important and what is central, and is very much a big part of the antidote to Dibas Haaretz and Lashon Hara. And perhaps all the more so in the middle of Sfira, when we feel a certain disconnect between the mourning that we observe during this time. Now it's already Rosh Chodesh, so we're in the middle of Sfira according to all opinions. And to have Yom HaAtzmaut in the middle of that, maybe is not necessarily a stira, but actually not necessarily a stira in emotions, but comes to help us appreciate that Sfiras HaOmer is about, as we head towards Kabbalah Satorah, we have to remember the respect that we need to have for each other, that the Gemara telling us in Yevamos that the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva died because they did not show respect to each other. And however that is meant to be understood, the message is clear that this is a time when we're supposed to refocus on having respect for each other, on appreciating just what the totality of a human being is, and how insignificant some of the complaints that we sometimes have really are when viewed against that appreciation. So Sfiras HaOmer is asking us to remember that. And Yom HaAtzmaut is also reminding us of that. So Yom HaAtzmaut in the middle of Sfiras HaOmer is a way of keeping our perspective on what's important and understanding just exactly how all of that comes together. And that's also the theme of the Avera of Lashon Hara and of the consequences of Negayim that we read about in these Parshios. So there is a very powerful Medrash in the beginning of Parshios Metzora that had a tremendous impact on Klal Yisrael and is a topic of much, much analysis. And I say it has impact on Klal Yisrael because the Sefer Chafetz Chaim has had a tremendous impact on Klal Yisrael. And it's really essentially inspired by this Medrash, that the Medrash tells about a traveling salesman who came to Tzipori and he asked everybody who's interested in the secret to long life. And everyone thought he was selling some kind of elixir, some kind of snake oil. So they all gathered around him. And it turns out that he wasn't selling any potions. He was selling a psukim. And he opened up a Sefer Tehillim. And he said, Mi ha'isha chafetz chaim, ohev yamim l'ros tov, mitzor l'shon chameiros, tosach medaber mirma. And if you want to live a long life, if you love life, so then what's the secret? The secret is Nisor Lashon Chameiros Fasach Medaber Mirma. And apparently he had a huge impact on his audience. The Medrash says that Rav Yanai was totally blown away by this and never realized this. And it's all very fascinating because the prohibition of Lashon Hara, like you said, is coming up in the Parsha Yisun and Parsha Kedoshim. What was added by this particular presentation that was so impactful, and that phrase, Chafetz Chaim, of course, is what Yisrael Meir Kagan used for his Sefer that had such an influence on Klal Yisrael. There are many, many suggestions as to what the message is. But among the suggestions is that the whole idea of a positive framing, right, that he's not just saying that Lashon Hara is bad, but he's saying that if you want to have any real sense of what is good in this world, if you want to be able to benefit from what life has to offer, it's not just a fire and brimstone speech that if you commit this avera is maybe terrible consequence. If you want to have goodness, if you want to have positivity, so then the attitude and the orientation that you have that reflects itself in how you speak has to be said accordingly. And that focus, together with also the idea saying, oh, v'yomim liros tov, that he's not just talking about the spiritual benefits, not just saying that follow these halachos and you'll have a good schar olam haba. Saying, in this world, if you want to be able to thrive in this world, in your relationships, and to have a meaningful and productive life that is not weighed down by machlokes and by infighting and by missed opportunities, so then understand how you have to see things and what kind of perspective you need to incorporate. And you know, it's interesting. There are many, many statements that Chazal have about the severity of Lashon Hara. It's really staggering just how much you can find in Chazal about how terrible Lashon Hara is. And one of the scariest statements, perhaps, is actually not explicitly in Chazal. It's most clearly attributed to Rabbeinu Bachya and L'chol v'salavavos, but there are many suggestions that maybe it's hinted at in various statements of Chazal, and in fact some find a source for it in this Medrash. And what the L'chol v'salavavos describes is that after 120 years, you're going to show up in Shemayim, and you're going to want to collect all of your schar for your life well lived here on earth, and you'll put in your PIN number and you'll open up your account and you'll be shocked at what you see. That you'll find that here you expected a whole list of all these wonderful mitzvahs that you did and they're all gone. And instead there's a whole list of averus that you don't remember doing. So what happened? So the answer apparently is you'll be told, once you complain about your account, you'll be told that yeah, apparently you spoke Lashon Hara about people. And when you do that, they get all your mitzvos and you get all their others. A pretty scary consequence. So there's a lot written about where that comes from, as we said. Maybe it somehow emerges from the language that Medrash and Parshas Metzora. And there are various explanations that are given in the Sefer Michtav Melio with Dessler. He offers a few suggestions as to why this is appropriate. Why is this a midah keneged midah kind of thing? And among the suggestions he gives is that if you're trying to hurt someone by speaking about them, so a big part of the power to hurt comes from your own personal stature. That if you're not somebody of any bearing, of any reputation, so then people won't care necessarily what you say. But if you're somebody of stature, so then you could do a lot of damage by speaking badly. So perhaps it's appropriate that the one who's trying to cause problems for others by talking about them, that the onus is that his own stature is diminished so significantly. But another take he has on it, similar but a little bit differently. So one of the major yetzaharas that we have for Lashon Hara, one of the main motivations that there are for Lashon Hara, the Chafetz Chaim wrote in one place that among the whole laundry list of averus that you commit when you speak Lashon Hara, so one of them is Achil Hashem. And surprisingly, you wouldn't expect this to be a controversial point, but the Chazon Ish actually disagreed with this. The Chazon Ish said, no, it's not Achil Hashem, it's just a normal aver. Why would that be so controversial? So the Chafetz Chaim said that the reason, wanted to give a few explanations why he thought it was a Chil Hashem more than a Stam Avera. And one reason is, he says, because there's no Yetzahara for Lashon Hara. Something that you do just to anger God. It's not like eating non-kosher food that might be tempting or stealing money. This is no Yetzahara for. So the Chazon Ish responded to that and said the fact that the Chafetz Chaim can say there's no Yetzahara for Lashon Hara, that is proof that the holy author never tasted a taste of Lashon Hara in his life. So how can you think there's no Yetzahara? The rest of us all know that there is a temptation. So what exactly that temptation is, one of the big aspects of it is we call miskabed b'klon chaveru. That somebody who wants to knock other people down, so he will look bigger by comparison. So therefore, he disparages others, and he hopes that that will make him look more impressive. So if that's the idea, Rav Dessler explains, again, you could understand midah keneged midah, that this individual who loses all of his chuyos and gets all the averus of this victim, so he was trying to lift up his status by knocking down the other guy. So it makes sense that the opposite happens, that instead his own status is diminished and the person he was trying to hurt gets lifted up as a consequence. And the truth is, that's something which you don't have to look only for Olam Haba to see. That's a real world consequence. Because very often, if you try to hurt someone else so that you will benefit by comparison, very often your audience is smarter than you think. And they can tell what you're trying to do. And The result is they'll have more sympathy for the person that you're speaking about and less respect for you. So it's actually a consequence that maybe is both Olam Haba and Olam Hazeh as well. That even if what the Chovas HaLevav is describing is literally true, it's also something that you see happening here in Olam Hazeh, that people who engage in that kind of talk end up backfiring back on themselves, and their own stature is diminished while they create sympathy for the people that they're trying to knock down. So this idea of Ovyabim L'Ros Tov, it's in this world that if somebody wants to have a happy life here, here and now, so then he has to understand how to properly appreciate the people around him, and how that should express itself in how he talks, and that the land of Eretz Yisrael is very much of a piece with that. So to have a day where we focus our attention on everything that is a bracha, everything that is phenomenal providence and hashgacha, that is connected to our ability to access land of Israel and the tremendous blessing that it brings to the whole world, is crucially important for our perspective and our attitude and the potential that we in the world has for a thriving and flourishing future. So to get a little more specific while still speaking generally about Parshas Tezriah and Metzorah, so like everything we've seen so far in Vayikra, after next week Vayikra is going to become much more relatable. But until now, Vayikra and the second half of Shmos very much deals with things that we don't actually encounter in our daily lives at this particular point in history. And we've spoken about before how that makes it maybe harder to relate to these parashios, but actually gives us a greater obligation in terms of learning about them. A, to replace what we don't actually practice, and also because the symbolic value is even greater, a point of emphasis when the mitzvos are not actually things that we're doing. So these parashios, Tezriah Metzorah, it has a different element to it, in the same direction, but a different way, that these nigoyim that we're going to read about, so we don't actually experience them, we don't actually experience them as much as that. And in essence, that's a bad thing, because we're losing out on this opportunity for direct feedback. And that's really a bracha, to be able to have that kind of assessment that we know then to correct. And Chafetz Chaim explains, if I'm not mistaken, that the reason we don't see these negayim nowadays, the reason they don't happen to us anymore, is because we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, we don't have everything that we're going to read about here as a possibility to deal with it. We don't have the ability to become Torah again. And that was the whole point. Right? The whole point was not that we should suffer. The point is that we should learn from it and that we should know what to do. And that will have this immediate kind of feedback for our behavior and our attitudes. And we'll be able to take corrective action and to rejoin. You know, the imagery is very explicit. That we're told that the whole idea of being sent out of the machana is that Chazal tell us that this person, by his speech, created division within the world, within society, and made people separate from each other in anger and in contentiousness. And therefore, he has to be separated. In other words, he should reflect the same idea, like we're saying, with the real world consequences, that he should reflect upon how he brought this consequence to others through emotional and interpersonal methods, and learn to correct that. So since we don't have that whole process of correction, so then the whole area of Negayim is not really going to work for us, because it's not about the suffering and the isolation, it's about learning how to respond to that in a positive way. And of course, we have just gone through a year plus of actual isolation. The whole theme of being quarantined and being isolated is one that we relate to more than maybe we ever have in our lives after this past year. And it's also an opportunity to cultivate a much greater appreciation for what connectedness means and for the fragility of that connectedness, and how we have to be especially careful not to do anything to cause rifts and to cause discord among people, especially when it's not justified or proportionate. And we have been forced into the closest version of what we read about in these parashios as far as the consequences over this past year. And we are anxiously awaiting, with the application of the vaccines now, we're anxiously awaiting being freed from that situation. But we have an ability to relate to the parsha in a stronger way than we've had in the past years. A year ago, when we read these parashas, we were just starting to have that experience in our lives. And so, in a different way than the first few parashas in Vayikra at the end of Shmos, here again, we have psukim that don't directly relate to our current lives right now, even if they do more than they ever have. But studying these psukim and trying to really reflect upon their messages is something which has maybe even more importance for us today than it did when these ideas were actually practiced. So, in the interest of time, we're not going to really go pasuk by pasuk in Sheni of both Tezriah and Metzora, but just to look a little bit at least at Sheni of Tezriah, and just to maybe call your attention to a few points that draw out this idea that there's a symbolism here that we're supposed to learn from. So the beginning of Shani, talking about somebody who has developed something on his skin, and you have to figure out what's going on. Pasuk says, Yud Gimel Vav, first Pasuk in Shani, V'ra HaKohen Osov Yom HaShvi Shanis. So now on the seventh day, the Kohen looks at him the second time. V'nei Keho HaNega. So if the mark, if the affliction has become darker, V'lofa So HaNega Bar, but it hasn't spread, then v'tiharo ha-kohen v'spachasi v'chibes begadu v'taher. So then he is declared tahar, and it's just v'spachas, and he washes his clothes and he's tahar. So v'lo fasa, here the pasuk says, so what if it did? So apparently he's tamed. So Rashi has a language that, what if amad, what if it's the same? Hasn't changed at all. So Rashi says there again that he's tummy. So the problem is that doesn't seem to be the din. The Mishnah in the Gaim, the first parak in the Gaim, says if it stayed the same, then we don't send him out of the camp. So why is Rashi there saying he's tummy? And it's something that Sfarim try to figure out at length, because it seems like a real contradiction to the halacha. But it does seem to be the pasha reading of the pasuk, so there's already a tension there. So among the suggestions Rav Moshe Feinstein has in his Darash Moshe, that it's both, that he is Tamei, but he doesn't have the consequences of Tumah. And that's what the Mishnah is saying, is he can reconcile Rashi in the Mishnah. And he discusses there what the whole point is, that we're trying to figure out what degree is manifesting here in terms of what level of avera. And if you have somebody who's misbehaving, but not in a way that he is impacting others, he's not having that destructive impact on others, so then it's somewhere in the middle. It's tame, but we don't have to put him in isolation in the same way. So once again, there's this careful attention to the details and the imagery that they represent. And we also find here the very surprising halacha that if we find that this affliction ends up covering his entire body, right? So this is, just skip the pasuk yigimel, that if it covers kol b'saro, so then what's the halacha? So then he's tar. So then he's declared pure. So this seems very counterintuitive, that if it gets so intense, it covers him completely. So then that turns into something that's tar. So as you can imagine, there's Ein HaMikra HaZeh Omer Ela Darsheni, that there is a message here as well. And among the Rishon and many Achronim, there are many different suggestions as to what that message is. Why is it that if the affliction covers your entire body, that paradoxically you're going to be tar? So one suggestion is that we're afraid of the influence this person has on other people. And that's always going to be when there is a mixture of good and bad, so then people get misled. But if somebody is completely consumed by this tzaras, so then everyone understands, okay, so that's clearly a bad guy. That's somebody who's not going to have any influence on anyone else, and we don't have to worry about him that much. Others have different types of suggestions. Schwab suggested along similar lines that it's not a real tumor if it doesn't have some connection to something tar. If it's kulo tame, then that's already something else. And the Chazal, the Gemara and Sanhedrin, you know, explained that this has to do with also the imagery of the Mashiach coming when the door is kulo chayef. Paradoxically flips into the other direction and they connect it to this pasuk. So that's how Rav Schwab explained. Some suggest it means that it's already now heading towards Tara because it must be that it's just completely breaking by covering the entire surface. The Rabbi Simon has in his Sefer quotes the idea that this is about not spreading yourself too thin. It becomes meaningless. But Netziv and others suggest here that there's imagery that if the whole point of this tzaras is that it's supposed to be musr, it's supposed to be something that is going to have an influence, so then it has to have some subtlety to it. It can't just be a sledgehammer just covering the entire body. That's not going to get across. That's something that's not going to make its point. And it suggests that's why the lashon is, the pasuk doesn't say that the person is tar necessarily. It says that this affliction doesn't constitute the kind of tzaras that you get excluded for, and that this is something that is not in this parsha, not in this whole category of being a useful tool for musar, a useful tool for correction. That's a powerful idea here as well. Just on a different note, towards the end of this aliyah, I'll make a note to one other pasuk here that will connect it to Mitzorah. So just the ideas we've been talking about a lot this year about the relationship between Dinim Darabanan and Dinim Daraisa. So here Pasuk Yudala has the language Uviyom Hiroz Bo Basuchai Yitzma, on that day that you show it. So the Gemara Moed Katan and Daf Zayin says that seems to suggest that language on the day that there are some days that you don't. And one example of a day when we don't have the kohen look at the negayim is a chasan in his days of shavu brachos. So we don't put him in the position of having to be assessed this way during the days of shavu brachos. So if you recall, the Ritva, the first parak of Moed Katan, has a discussion about this, that something you have to figure out exactly how this works, because that we assume shavu brachos is din d'rabbanan. And maybe it's a din d'rabbanan is very, very old, may go back to Moshe Rabbeinu, but nonetheless, not a din from the Torah itself, or maybe there's some aspect of Minat Torah, but not the whole Shavu Brachos is Minat Torah. And the Ritva there has a suggestion, maybe this is an example of Masr HaKasav L'Chachamim, which I think is something we spoke about earlier in the year, we talked about in the context of Chol HaMoed, that there are some dinim which Chazal come to define, but in their essence is really a din Minat Torah. And maybe that's one path to understanding this, that here it seems that the Din Drabanan is affecting the Din Minat Torah. This Din of Shavu Brachos is going to come into this Din of when the Kohen is going to actually go through with this process. So just to continue that theme of the interaction of Din of Drabanan and Din of Daraisa for a moment, and to take us into Mitzorah, because to continue that theme from here, and also to very much parallel something we spoke about last week, you find another example. This is going to require us cheating a little bit because it's really in Rishon of Mitzorah, but I think it's okay in special circumstances. But if you look in Parsha Mitzorah and Parak Yudalit Pasuk Hey, so here we're talking about this whole purification process and the birds, and the Pasuk says Vitziva Akoi V'Shachar Esai Tzipor Hayachas El Klicheres Al Mayim Chaim. So he should shecht, the Kohen shechts one of the birds into a utensil of clay and over living water. So Shlomo Kluger in Sefer Tuv Tam Vidas he raises the question that Mishnah in Chulin, which is brought lahalach in Yerideya, says you're not supposed to shecht into a kli or into water, because somebody may look at that and think that you're actually shechting to some deity, to some avodah zarah. So he raised the question, and if you recall, we had this discussion last week in a different context, that how could there be a rabbinic prohibition if the psukim describe doing it? Right? Even though Chazal would have come later, and so it's not obviously a problem to have the psukim not account for the din d'rabbanan, but the question is, what about the taz? Right? We discussed this last week in a different context. Last week we talked about putting non-kosher meat on top of kosher meat. So the Torah seems to describe doing that there, and the question was, if that's a prohibition of Rabbanan, like it sounds like from the Gemara and the Chulin, so doesn't the Taz say that Chazal don't make dinim that contradict explicit psukim in the Chumash? So Shlomo Kluger, in a sefer Tam Vidas, so he raises this question. So how could it be that there's a prohibition of shechting into a kli? Here we have a pasuk that says that's exactly what happened here. So I saw in one sefer, the sefer was called Kerem Yaakov, that he quotes an answer from Rav Moshe Namiat of Gateshead, that here you can't say this contradicts the Taz, because here we're saying this was the mitzvah to do it this way. So this could be an exception to a normal situation. So it's not any contradiction to say, in general, you shouldn't do this, and the Chazal came along and made that a prohibition. And here, in this case, this is how it was said to be done. And it shouldn't say that that is any kind of a problem for the Taz's premise, because it's not actually going to create a contradiction between the Din Drabbanan and what's written in the Torah. So there's a lot to say about that. It just continues that whole theme. I have to acknowledge that I have an extra motive in quoting that pshat that the Sefer quotes from Rav Moshe Namiat, because he was my great-grandfather, so I was happy to see that quote in the Sefer, and that's what he suggested to respond to this point of Shlomo Kluger. So it's one more detail about this whole question of the interaction between the Dinim D'Oraisa and Dinim D'Rabbanan, which has come up so many times this year. To be honest, it comes up every year because it's a major theme in studying Torah Sheval Peh, but this is just one more application of that. Maybe we'll also just close by noting also, as relevant to the whole Yom HaAtzmaut theme and something to appreciate, that the psukim also going beyond our Sheni limits, but just allow the reference that here the pasuk Yud Dalid Lamed Dalid in Mitzora states here Kisavo Eretz Kanan Asher Nosim Lachem LaAchuzah V'Nasati Neged Saras B'Beis Eretz Achuzastem. So you're going to go into the land of Canaan that I'm giving to you as a possession, and you're going to find these situations where these afflictions are going to actually affect the houses too. You have this concept of Nigai Batim, of Tsaras of the house, which is very much in the realm of Drasha, because the Gemara actually says about this, that this is one of the mitzvahs in the Torah that never actually happened in real life, at least according to one opinion. It's like Hira Nidachas and Ben Sora Mora. So why is it there? It's there, Drosh V'Kabel Schar. It's there to be a topic of drasha. It's there for us to expound upon. So what's very striking is that Rashi here quotes an idea that this is going to be a bracha for you. That this is good news. You're going to come into the land and you're going to find that you're going to have afflicted houses. So it's a strange idea. Why exactly is that good? So Rashi quotes that there's going to be treasure that was in these houses from what the earlier populations had left there, and by taking apart the house, you're going to end up finding it, and it's going to be good for you. And this is also connected, the Gemara in Maseches Yuma is going to be Daf Yomi next week, talks about how this is also part of the whole process of trying to correct flawed midos, that it's not just Lashon Hara, but it's also stinginess, which is also related, that you have an attitude that you don't want to help people. So if somebody comes to ask you for something he needs to borrow, and you say you don't have it, and then you end up having to take apart your whole house. Everyone's going to see what you have, and it's going to be clear that you were just being stingy. It's also a part of the corrective and stinginess. It sounds like it's a separate midah from Lashon Hara, but really it's part of the same idea. It goes back to that Miskabe Beklon Chavero idea that you think there's just not enough credit to go around, there's not enough compliments to go around, so the only way I'm going to be able to boost myself is by knocking you down. That's itself an aspect of the stinginess. So all of this is to help correct our midos and to correct our perspective. But the idea that it's presented as good news when this is happening is it's definitely interesting. And the Rashi of Karmi Avner of Golvich Tzron Lebracha has a whole sikha about this, where he notes that this is a part of the bad that comes with the good. That when you will come into Canaan, and you will come into your own land, and you will have your own society that you have to maintain, that comes with responsibilities. But those responsibilities are themselves a siman of that which is, by its very nature, a bracha. So, you know, if somebody is a renter, so then he doesn't own his house. So if he has problems, so then he calls the landlord, he calls the superintendent, they got to take care of it. And when somebody actually owns the property, decides to buy a property, so now all the problems are his problems. But the fact that they're his problems is really a good thing. It's because it's his house. It's because he has ownership. So too, this may be a problem in the short term, but it's a part of a big bracha. It's a part of something that reflects that there is tremendous blessing here, that you have come into your land, you have come into your achuza, and you'll have to deal with things, but that itself is a statement of something very positive. And it's also, again, something that we appreciate in Yom HaAtzmaut, the fact that we have a Medinas Yisrael, that we have a nation that is ours to worry about. And certainly, as we all know, it has not been simple these past 70 plus years, going back before, and certainly these past years has not been simple by any definition. But it's all a reflection of the central truth, the central bracha that God has bestowed upon us. So to be able, of course, having Yom HaZikaron right before Yom HaAtzmaut is a part of appreciating just how not simple it is, and just how much of a cost, how much of a price has to be paid. But ultimately, that it's for a purpose. Ultimately, that it's associated with something that is a tremendous bracha, and that it should only grow and develop in that direction. And a huge part of that is our ability to appreciate that and recognize that. So that should all continue to be strengthened in our minds as we observe this Yom HaAtzmaut. And we should be zocha next year to feel that even more intensely. We should be out of our isolation from the pandemic, and we should be out of our galus in every sense of the word. And we should only know greater things from here on in. Wish you all a wonderful Yom HaAtzmaut, a wonderful Shabbos, and I look forward, God willing, to seeing you on Sunday, and wish you all you know good things. All right. Shikara. All right, so again, on